Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. William Pelham Barr, Attorney General of the United States of America. He's something of a mystery. To his defenders, he's upholding the rule of law. To his critics, he's undermining it. To his defenders, he's not enabling a rogue president, but protecting the presidency itself. But to his critics, Bill Barr is laying the groundwork for a presidency beholden to no one. So this hour on Point, who exactly is William Barr, and what exactly is he doing as Attorney General? And you can join us. The Attorney General of the United States is attacking his own Inspector General this week. What impact do you think that will have on the Justice Department and on the rule of law in the long term? Or when Barr says he's protecting the executive branch, does he have the right read of the Constitution? Or is he setting up a system where one person, the President of the United States, is above the law? You can join us at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me today from Washington is David Rivkin. He served under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the White House Counsel's Office and at the Department of Justice. He worked with William Barr during his time in government. And David is a member of the Federalist Society, though he's not here today to speak for the organization. David Rivkin, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
Also with us from Washington is Mary McCord. She was acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Justice Department, bridging both the Obama and Trump administrations. As such, she led the Justice Department's investigation of foreign meddling into the 2016 election and possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. Today, she teaches law at Georgetown University and is legal director of the school's Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. Mary McCord, welcome to you.
Hello. Nice to be here, Meghna.
So first of all, I just want to play a little bit of tape to bring people up to speed in terms of what's already happened this week regarding the Justice Department's Inspector General report. Now, as you know, Inspector General Michael Horowitz had multiple findings in his report, including 17 significant inaccuracies and omissions in the FBI's handling of FISA applications. He said he was deeply concerned about those fundamental errors. But he also said that he didn't find any intentional wrongdoing on the part of the FBI. But here is Michael Horowitz testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday in an exchange with South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
Former FBI Director James Comey said this week that your report vindicates him. Is that a fair assessment of your report?
I think the activities we found here don't vindicate anybody who touched this.
Okay.
Well, Michael Horowitz, again, the Inspector General, also said that he did not find that the FBI was politically motivated when it investigated Russian interference in the 2016 elections. And here he is in an exchange with California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Your report states that you didn't find documentary or testimonial evidence that political bias or improper motivation played a role.
That's correct.
Thank you. And you didn't find a deep state conspiracy against candidate or President Trump.
So, as to the opening, we found no bias, no testimonial documentary evidence on that.
That's the Justice Department's Inspector General, Michael Horowitz. Well, here is a little bit on how the Attorney General of the United States responded to these findings. Here's Bill Barr on NBC News.
The core statement, in my opinion, by the IG is that these irregularities, these misstatements, these omissions were not satisfactorily explained. And I think that leaves open the possibility to infer bad faith.
So, Mary McCord, let's start with what Bill Barr is saying this week. What do you make of it? What is he telegraphing here?
Well, I think it sounds a little like sour grapes, right? His own inspector general, the inspector general for the Justice Department, reached a conclusion that the investigation was not motivated by political bias, did find significant errors made by the FBI. And these are things, frankly, as a person in the Department of Justice at the time who was on the receiving end of information from the FBI, I'm very disappointed in those mistakes as well. But when the inspector general you know, very explicitly reached a conclusion that there was no political bias motivating this investigation. And the Attorney General, William Barr, comes out and says, well, because of lack of explanation, I think we can infer bad faith. That's just a dispute on a conclusion about a conclusion that Michael Horowitz had already reached. And it strikes me, again, as another attempt, as we've seen repeatedly by this Attorney General since he came into office, to support the president's own statements about the Department of Justice and the FBI and the Russia investigation, and to do so using language that is unnecessary and is defeating and undermining the not only the inspector general, certainly the FBI, but also the department itself as sort of an independent agency. I mean, it's part of the executive branch. I'm not quarreling with that. And policy-wise, it's certainly the attorney general. It is within his purview and his obligation to carry out the president's policies. I'm not quarreling with that, but there's a difference between carrying out policies and being the president's spokesperson or the president's personal attorney.
Hmm. So, David Rivkin, this is the central question here, as Mary McCord has articulated it. Do you see a pattern in Bill Barr's statements, in his decisions, that are an attempt to support the president at the cost of the integrity of the Department of Justice?
Not at all, and I hope we'll talk a little bit at least about some constitutional issues that are reflected in General Barr's recent speeches, but let's talk about the IG report. Look, I'm a little puzzled by two things. First of all, as Mary knows perfectly well, no disrespect intended to IG, this IG or any of IG, attorneys general have almost invariably registered some disagreements with IG reports. Okay, that's called healthy debate, point number one. Point number two, and we have to be very precise, Mayer said twice that Mike Horowitz did not find, concluded that there was no political motivation in what has been done to the Trump campaign and then Trump presidency. That's not what he said, and I remind your listeners to about the exchange between him and Senator Feinstein. He found no testimonial or documentary evidence of such a thing. And he is a man who is acting with probity. He is not making inferences, but in life we do make inferences. If you have, if in the context of a disciplinary proceedings or criminal prosecutions, Magna, and there are 18 different pieces of conduct at a given organization that goes one way. Let's say there are 18 instances of sexual harassment by 18 different people in a corporation. Does Mayor really think that it would not be probative for the trier of fact if there is a civil or criminal investigations about that? It's ludicrous. Of course there is. Point number one. Point number two. Look, I think General Barr is being forthcoming not from the perspective of defending the president, but giving American public a fair notice, which is good. I think that's what government officials should be doing as to where things are going. Look, it was a good investigation, but I don't need to get in over details about what's his remit, meaning the inspector general. Only really current employees within the Department of Justice and FBI, no remit of the intelligence community, which played, in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of many folks, a very important role in what happened in 2016 and 2017. We have a Durham investigation that, by the way, very important for your listeners to appreciate, was upgraded to a criminal investigation and was broadened in terms of timeline to include 2017. And not to be legalistic here, but the only reason to look at 2017, if you think something bad, potentially predicated criminally, occurred in 2016. General Barr is very much involved in it based upon public accounts working with Durham. So he's just trying to tell the American people, look, that's not the final word. That's not a diss of IG. That's just warning what's to come.
Okay.
And
well,
doesn't do anything to for one last point. To criticize bad things that happen in the Department of Justice, since when is that against institutional interest? If you see bad things, you want to root them out and do better in the future. That's kind of an American way.
Okay. Well, let me get Mary McCord to answer there. David Rivkin sort of unpacked a lot for us. First of all, what do you make of his assessment that Barr is acting in good faith when, you know, even if the attorney general found no documentable evidence that the pattern holds, that there might have been political bias.
Well, I think that, you know, I was surprised when the attorney general appointed John Durham to do an investigation of the investigators after the inspector general was already well into its own investigation of the origins of the Russia investigation. I know that's a lot of uses of the word investigation in one sentence, because I thought it would have made more sense for him to await the results of the inspector general's report and then determine was there a need for further investigation. So thing one, I was surprised and concerned and really didn't understand what the point of that was. Now that we have both of these, one is now a final report. The other investigation, John Durham's investigation, is ongoing. I think it's improper for the attorney general to be making statements about essentially, you know, what is an ongoing investigation. I think it was improper for John Durham to do that as well the other day. And so to the extent that what Barr has done in disputing the IG's some of the IG's statements and conclusions from his report and suggesting that maybe something different will be coming out of the Durham report, those are things we wait for the end of the Durham's investigation for. So I agree with David that it's good, it's healthy for our democracy, and it's healthy for the Department of Justice as well as all other departments and agencies to have a critical look at the way they operate. And that's why all the departments and agencies have offices of inspector general. And that's why Michael Horowitz did this investigation, which, again, was at the request of folks on Capitol Hill who came and asked for this, you know, more than, well, almost 2 years ago. But I think getting out ahead of the reports and the conclusions of investigations is always dangerous, and it tends to create a narrative for the public that may just affects things going forward in a way that can be very unfair.
Well, we are talking this hour about Attorney General Bill Barr and his take on the Constitution, his leadership of the Justice Department, and the impact that's having long term on the DOJ and the rule of law as a whole. I'm joined today by Mary McCord and David Rivkin. We'll talk a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Attorney General Bill Barr and his leadership of the Department of Justice and his view of the rule of law and his support for a strong executive branch and what effect that's having on government right now, on the norms we have in government, and the future of the Department of Justice. I'm joined today by Mary McCord. She was acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Justice Department from 2016 to 2017. And currently, she's legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center. David Rivkin joins us as well. He served under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the White House Counsel's Office and at the Department of Justice. He's a member of the Federalist Society, though does not speak for the organization today, and he is currently a partner at the law firm of Baker Hostetler. David and Mary, we'll get to sort of Barr's view on the Constitution, I promise you, in just a minute. But I wanted to ask you one follow-up question, David. because you talked about how you didn't have any concerns with Barr's criticism or reaction to the Inspector General's report, because, as you quoted back when Michael Horowitz said that they found no bias or no testimonial documentary evidence of political bias, but that if you look at the pattern, one could infer such. I just wonder, why is it that Bill Barr doesn't apply that same reasoning to the President of the United States? I mean, it seems as if he has demonstrated a pattern of behavior vis-a-vis Russia or his interactions regarding Ukraine, which is what's brought the nation to this point of almost impeachment. Why is Bill Barr not applying that same reasoning to the president?
Well, because the circumstances are quite different. The president has tremendous, in my opinion, I think in the opinion of many constitutional scholars, Megan has tremendous discretionary powers, particularly when it comes to foreign affairs. The president can drive foreign affairs vis-a-vis Ukraine and vis-a-vis Russia pretty much as he sees fit as the head of a unitary executive, sort of jumping into the constitutional discussion. Mm-hmm. Whether you like his policies or not, there's nothing unconstitutional about it. There's no crime and misdemeanor as far as that is concerned. By contrast, officials in the Department of Justice and FBI have some discretion, okay, but nothing in the context of law enforcement, have prosecutorial discretion, but nothing approaching the president's discretion. And there's a fundamental difference, I'm sure your listeners would appreciate, between somebody, you know, doing something wrong in the context of an application to FISC for an intelligence surveillance court, or in the context of opening an investigation, and the president changing our foreign policy towards Russia or China or North Korea. They're just apples and oranges. So it's not a question of inferences. It's the question of – it's nothing to infer here. We do know what President Trump's view is towards Russia, towards Ukraine, towards China, towards North Korea. But there's no criminality here. There's no discipline to be meted out. That ain't the same with regard to FBI and DOJ officials. Does that make sense to you?
Well, yes. And I just want to see what Mary has to say about that.
Well, I didn't really take that as a response to your question, right, Meghna, actually. So if what David is wanting to get into is a discussion about whether the president committed high crimes and misdemeanors, which is being discussed on Capitol Hill right now as we speak, we can move toward that. I didn't think that was, and I'm happy to do that. You know, I look at this as, I guess, a little bit along the lines of your question, which is, I think you can look not only at the OIG report on what were the origins of the investigation and were they properly predicated, and his conclusion was, yes, they were. You can then look at what the Mueller report itself came up with after its two-year investigation, which did show a pattern. Again, the conclusion of Mr. Mueller was that there was no crime of conspiracy or coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia, but there was very much a welcoming of the Trump campaign and Trump himself towards Russia's interference. And then, of course, if you go to Volume 2, you get into a lot of facts and evidence put forward by Mr. Mueller that would support obstruction of justice offenses against the president were he not the current sitting president of the United States. That is why things have moved into Congress's realm to review these things. And then, of course, in the midst of all that, we had the whistleblower and the revelations about the president and those around him seeking to have the president of Ukraine do politically motivated favors for the president in return for military aid and an Oval Office meeting. So if we look at patterns, I think there are many inferences that can be drawn from the patterns that we see coming out of the White House.
But the only thing, for 2 seconds, I want to be making a responsive to your question. My only point is it is not the job of our attorney general, any subordinate executive branch officer, to draw policy inferences about presidential conduct. So unless his conduct is unlawful, and I strongly disagree, but it is, it's not a job of General Barr or any other attorney general to draw inferences. It is manifestly his job to draw inferences about misconduct, possible misconduct by people within DOJ and FBI. It's just apples and oranges.
It's not the attorney general's job to draw inferences about the conduct of the president of the United States.
Unless it implicates some concerns about criminal law. And my point is that it does not implicate any such concerns. Look, you can disagree with what President Trump is doing vis-a-vis China. There are a lot of people who think that we should not be engaged in trade wars. Is that the job of General Barr to draw inferences about it? Or may disagree with his views about Russian interference or Ukrainian interference? These are all policy issues, for God's sake.
Well,
what's there to infer?
So, you know, we could... to Mary's point, we could sort of draw ourselves into a discussion about the particularities around President Trump. But I do, and I'm sure that will come into the conversation again, but I do want to keep digging into how we can best understand Attorney General Bill Barr here. Because, Mary, let me just start with you on this. He does seem to be consistent in his career. I mean, back when he was Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush, in his stalwart support for the centrality of the executive. He is consistent in that.
Yes, I think that's right in terms of his own interpretation of the presidential authorities under the Constitution. But I would note that many of the things, and to go back to David's point about drawing inferences, the Attorney General has done this repeatedly. When he, on the morning of the actual release of the Mueller report, held a press conference, he said, there's substantial evidence to show the president was frustrated and angered by his sincere belief that the investigation was undermining his presidency. And he went on to make sort of excuses for the behaviors that were revealed in great detail in the Mueller report. So the suggestion that the Attorney General is not drawing inferences about the president's, you know, conduct, and maybe, I guess maybe David's response would be those are specifically with respect to whether criminal laws were broken. And of course, William Barr took it upon himself after Mr. Mueller did not reach a conclusion about whether crimes had been committed. And he did that because of the Office of Legal Counsel memo that says that a sitting president may not be indicted. Mr. Barr took it upon himself to go ahead and reach a legal conclusion and determine that no crimes had been committed. So he has definitely been drawing inferences about this president since he took office as the Attorney General, and we've seen that repeatedly.
If I may.
Well, David, I'll turn to you in a second, but just also to Mary's point, I mean, that frustrated Robert Mueller himself to the point he wrote that letter following Bill Barr's press conference complaining that the report itself or the publicly available or the sections of the report intended for public consumption should have spoken for themselves. But David Rivkin, go ahead.
Look, I hate to spend a lot of time rehashing the Mueller investigation, the report, but I'm sort of forced to. First of all, what General Barr promised during his confirmation, I think, again, his among his other characteristics is, again, the view that, particularly in the context of things that attract public attention, timely disclosure is essential. He wanted to tell the American people what was going on. Look, I hate to slam Mueller, but it has been well reported in both New York Times and Washington Post that Mueller failed to indicate in his report the time it went to the Attorney General which portions of it could be released, which could not because of either grand jury secrecy or classified information. So I hate to say it, but there's credible evidence that Mueller's office, let's say Mueller's office, not Mueller himself, did not make it easy or possible for the timely release of a whole report. So the Attorney General was in a situation where the American people wanted to know what really went down. Congress wanted to know what really went down. And General Barr did his best to summarize. And by the way, he reached the conclusion that there was no obstruction, Mary, not just because of OOC learning. If that was really the only about sitting president cannot be indicted, because if that were something that means that the sitting president cannot be criticized by Mueller, what's the point of having a Mueller investigation? And the conclusion that there was no obstructive conduct was not just General Barr's conclusion. It was Rod Rosenstein's conclusion. Remember Rosenstein, whom everybody praised as a saintly fellow, as a conclusion by head of Office of Legal Counsel, Steve Engel. From what I understand, it's a conclusion shared by a dozen senior officials in the Department of Justice, including many career people. So it was a joint conclusion. Okay? I'm frankly critical of Mueller for not having the courage to reach that conclusion himself, but he did work, his subordinate officer in the executive branch, he did work for Attorney General, And once he did not do that, the baton on that issue passed to Barr and his colleagues. It was a unanimous decision within DOJ. So let's give people credit for it.
Okay. So I don't want to keep getting pulled away from Bill Barr himself. But, Mary, I will give you a chance to respond to that. I mean, do you what's your reaction to David saying that quick press release and that tiny summary of Mueller's several hundred page report was the best that Barr could do given the urgency of the moment?
Well, you know, almost immediately, within just a couple of days of the Attorney General putting out his four-page supposed summary of the principal conclusions of the Mueller report, Mr. Mueller wrote a letter to Bill Barr saying that he had enclosed the very day after that four-page summary, he had sent on to Mr. Barr the introduction and executive summaries for each volume of the report marked with redactions to remove any information that potentially could be protected by the Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E. I'm reading from the letter right now. So there was provided to Mr. Barr the information he would have needed and was ready-made to just put out publicly, yet was not put out publicly. And so there was at least three and a half more weeks before the full report was put out where the narrative had already been created by Mr. Barr. With respect to the conclusions about obstruction, Mr. Barr said that he and Mr. Rosenstein, who I've worked with for years because I was a career prosecutor for more than 20 years before I went over to Maine Justice as a part of the National Security Division, where I was for 3 years, that he did indicate that they had reached that conclusion together. Hundreds and hundreds of former federal prosecutors wrote an open letter that was published after that when they reviewed the evidence that was detailed in the Volume 2 of the Mueller report, that they thought that it very well supported multiple counts of obstruction of justice. And I happen to agree with that conclusion, having prosecuted these cases myself for decades.
Okay, so let's return really to the core of how Bill Barr sees the executive here. And I'd like to do that by going back in time to when he was Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush, because as both of you will, of course, remember, we were dealing with the aftermath of Iran-Contra then, and President George H.W. Bush decided to pardon many people who had been wrapped up in Iran-Contra. I'm thinking specifically of Caspar Weinberger, who had been indicted on 5 felony charges, right, including obstruction and lying to Congress. He goes ahead and pardons Weinberger. Bill Barr very much supported that. And what's interesting to me is I was remembering that when Weinberger was pardoned, Judge Lawrence Walsh, who was the independent counsel who investigated Iran-Contra, he had this very strong statement. He said that President Bush's pardon undermines the principle that no man is above the law. It demonstrates that powerful people with powerful allies can commit serious crimes in high office, deliberately abusing the public trust without consequence. Now, David Rivkin, does Bill Barr's support of the Iran-Contra pardons give us insight into his view of, or does he view, almost limitless power in the executive? And is that good for America? Where are the checks and balances if that's the case?
Of course not. If I may briefly elaborate, look, I've had an opportunity to work with Bill Barr even before he was the AG. He was, as Mary knows, head of all Office of Legal Counsel, then the DAG, then Attorney General. So we're going back to Iran-Contra. Look, his view, which he expressed long before actually was pardons, is that we have a situation where the executive branch is under assault from Congress, where there's widespread criminalization of foreign policy differences, and that is enervates, to use a term a framers would be familiar with, emasculates perhaps would be a better word, the executive, particularly in the national security area, where the frame is expected the president to act with speed and dispatch. So it's not a question of somebody being – the whole notion about be above the law, below the law. The whole point of pardon, if you look at the discussion of a pardon power that the frame has had, it is meant to pardon somebody who may – I emphasize the word may because there are no convictions – may have been guilty in the public interest. So if you think that the executive branch is under assault from Congress – because of various independent counsel investigations. By the way, there's widespread bipartisan consensus, probably wouldn't happen now, but independent counsel exercise were not not a good thing, which is why they didn't authorize the independent counsel statute. So what General Barr did at that time was fully consistent with his overarching view, not partisanship, not who is the president, either political party-wise or personalities-wise, but his overall view of a separation of powers. Right. And, Megan, let me just say very briefly, to me, the problem is not overly powerful executive these days. It is omniscient and overly powerful Congress, which, by the way, I'm sick and tired of hearing everybody talk about how we did not want to have a king. Yes, the framers were concerned about overly powerful executive, but you want to take a stab at which branch they thought would be most powerful and needs to be cabined? The legislature, okay? So pushing back against that trend is not just good for somebody in the White House. It's good for individual liberty because the separation of powers and having robust executive as well as robust legislative branch and robust courts is what protects individual liberty in a most fundamental way, with, you know, Bill of Rights sort of being on top of that.
Well, Mary McCord, I promise I'm going to let you answer, give a response on the other side of the quick break that we have to take. So hang on here for just a second. We are talking about Attorney General Bill Barr and his leadership of the Justice Department, his view of the executive branch, and the impact that's having right now in Washington and the country. Mary McCord and David Rivkin join us. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Attorney General Bill Barr and his view of executive power in the United States, his leadership of the Justice Department as well. I'm joined today by David Rivkin. He served under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the White House Counsel's Office and at the Department of Justice as well. He's currently a partner at the law firm of Baker Hostetler. Mary McCord is with us. She was acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security in the Justice Department from 2016 to 2017 and Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's National Security Division from 2014 to 2016. Currently, she's a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center. And Mary, I'm going to let you have a crack at this question about Barr's view of the executive. But in order, before I do that, let me just play one moment from Attorney General Bill Barr's November 15th speech at the Federalist Society. It was quite a lengthy speech on his view of the centrality of the executive and how he sees it being under attack by Congress for many years, even decades. So here's Bill Barr.
I'm concerned that the deck has become stacked against the executive and that since the mid-60s, there's been a steady grinding down of the executive branch's authority that accelerated after Watergate. More and more, the president's ability to act in areas in which he has discretion has become smothered by the encroachments of the other branches.
Mary McCord, do you see the same smothered executive branch that Bill Barr sees? Or because we've talked to any number of constitutional scholars who would say there's been a vast expansion of executive power in the past several decades.
Yes, I disagree with Attorney General Barr's characterization of sort of encroachment by the other branches on the executive branch. And it's interesting for me because I did spend almost 25 years in the Department of Justice and certainly stood up for executive authority, particularly in the national security realm. There's no question that there's a large degree of deference given in the Constitution and certainly by the courts to the executive's authority when it comes to issues involving national security and foreign policy. And in many cases, I believe that's appropriate. And I've, you know, said so in my former roles within the department. However, I think there's a difference between deference to the executive in matters where it has superior access to information. So we're talking about access to intelligence and things like that and diplomatic relations and things. There's a difference between that and an authoritarian regime. And, some of the statements by Bill Barr at that Federal Society speech really seem to be sort of dangerously leaning toward that sort of more authoritarianism. I think, you know, when we look at the Constitution, there's no question that the framers intended for there to be a lot of overlapping authorities. That's what checks and balances is about. That's what separation of powers is about. But it's not clean cut. And I think a lot of people who are not students of the Constitution don't realize that there aren't clear lines always between authorities. There are overlapping authorities. For example, you know, Congress has the power to declare war, even though the president is the commander of chief. The president has the powers to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. But Congress, of course, has oversight authority and is the sole power of impeachment. Right. So there are and as we were just talking before the break, the president has the pardon authority. But again, there are other checks that Congress has. It can't undo a pardon. But if it thinks that that pardon authority has been abused in ways that reach the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, it could exercise its impeachment authority. And I'm not saying that's the factual context we're in right now, of course, but this is the way the Constitution is. It's not clear. It's not like you can look down one list and say these are Congress's powers and another list say these are the executive powers and not find them overlapping. So various scholars have different views about how much power any one branch should have. But I think it's important, even if we just accept that Bill Barr has a certain view of the Constitution, and I'm prepared to accept that, there are things that he is doing right now that are not just strictly within protecting what he views as executive authority. I mean, in that same speech to Federalist Society, he called out sort of the other side for the systematic shredding of norms and undermining the rule of law. So this sort of name calling is just not befitting the attorney general that represents the people of the United States. He's not there just to be Trump's personal attorney. And you can stand up for executive authority without name calling, without dividing the country into polarized camps, and without being partisan.
Right. So David Rivkin, respond to that, because I was in fact just going to ask you about that precise line that Mary quoted from Attorney General Barr's speech. I mean, when he says things like that, that the left is engaged in systematic shredding of norms and undermining the rule of law, how can we interpret that as anything other than Bill Barr will stand up for the executive under Republican administrations, but not under Democratic administrations, that he is behaving as a partisan attorney general?
Oh, I was hoping that we can talk more about the overlap between executive and congressional powers and whatnot, which issues I find intensely fascinating. But as far as his observation is concerned, look, I hate to disappoint anybody who's listening here, but I do think, I agree with General Barr, there is unfortunately a trend that's animated by partisanship, but also has a constitutional dimension. It so happens that the Democrats control the House of Representatives, do not control the White House, do not control the Senate, and they propound view of oversight power, impeachment power, that to me is profoundly at odds with what the framers created. To give you one example, Speaker Pelosi, God bless her, has said at least twice that Article 2, the executive, is not a co-equal branch. Now, I hope Mary would agree with me that that's a ludicrous statement. We can disagree about specific confrontations about how they would be resolved. Some of them are justiciable, some are not justiciable, but specific confrontation. But, I mean, we live in a world where, you know, Article 1, basically, a portion of Article 1 says Article 2 is not a co-equal branch. We're a supreme branch. In every example, I mean, We have a president, and I hate to get into impeachment, who's been accused of obstruction of Congress for exercising two privileges, the immediate advisor privilege and the national security privilege. The latter one goes back to 1807, okay? The first one goes back to 1970s and been articulated by presidents, as Mary knows, by both political parties. Forget the Ukraine and what happened there and all this other stuff. A president is being slammed by the House for asserting, in the absence of a definitive adjudication, the Supreme Court level to the contrary, that he is entitled to exert those privileges. One last point. This is Congress also, it takes the view of a speech and debate clause, which basically says they cannot be held responsible to anything, that co-equal branch. It comes to the ability of a president to armor himself in the exercise of his discretionary powers in the same type of privilege. Oh, no, it's obstructive. Just a couple of examples. Pelosi's symbolic statement about, you know, lack of co-equality and enormously muscular and overly aggressive exertion of congressional powers at the expense of the executive. And it's not being done by everybody. It's being done by the Democrats. I hate to say that.
Well, so David Rivkin, let me just ask you, did Bill Barr rise to the defense of the Obama administration when, after President Obama was elected to his first term, Republican congressional leadership said that it was their sole mission to make him a one-term president? Or when he nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, Mitch McConnell refused to go through the confirmation process. Did Bill Barr stand in defense of the executive then?
I do not know. He was not in the government at that time. Unlike some other people, I don't think he participated extensively in a public discourse about it. And you have to sort of separate things. Look, yes, the Republicans did say that it was a political statement. They didn't do anything specific to in terms of actual conduct. The Merrick Garland thing, look, the Senate, I think, has a right to sit on any nomination of it to the courts or the executive branch. Democrats have done it themselves. This is, let's just call it sharp conduct, and I don't want to get into what the Democrats have done, then they control the Senate. But the bottom line is we are in a world where there's sharp differences between the two political parties about their respective views of separation of powers. And I think it's highly regrettable. And look, by the way, not toot my own horn, it's not about me, but I've not supported President Clinton's impeachment that was taking place. And I've always supported the same robust view, for example, of the president's war-making powers and written about it, whether it was President Clinton, President Trump, or President Obama.
Well, Mary McCord, do you want to respond to that?
Well, there was a lot yeah. there. I'll hone in on just one piece of that. I agree with David that the president certainly can assert executive privilege in response to congressional subpoenas, but that's not actually what's happening right now. We have the president, the White House, and represented by the Department of Justice and Attorney General Barr asserting something called absolute immunity for not just the president, but for the president's aides, including Don McGahn and others, Mike Mulvaney and others. To say they don't even have to show up in response to subpoenas by Congress. They can just simply assert that they are absolutely immune from even showing up. Executive privilege is invoked on a question-by-question basis when the response to a question put forth by Congress would invade the interest protected by that privilege. There's no court authority or constitutional authority for this idea of absolute immunity as it applies to presidential aides. And that's being litigated in the courts right now. So I don't disagree at all that there are, you know, there are arguments to be made by the executive branch, arguments to be made by the legislative branch about how the interplay of their authorities should work. But this absolute position of absolute immunity, and let me just, I'm imagining David may respond, and I don't mean to put in words into your mouth, David, so please correct me if I'm wrong, that absolute immunity is not a new thing under this attorney general or this Office of Legal Counsel.
That's right.
Offices of legal counsel have been saying this for decades, and it has never once been accepted by the courts. And the offices of legal counsel usually will, although they'll say that presidential aides have absolute immunity, the reason we don't see this getting to the courts very often, only one other time has it, and that was with respect to Harriet Myers, And it was the idea was rejected by Judge John Bates in the District Court for the District of Columbia, and it never reached the Court of Appeals. And the reason it didn't reach the Court of Appeals there and the reason it doesn't come up that often is because normally the branches do try to work it out. They do try to work together. They do try to reach an accommodation to provide to Congress what Congress needs to do its job. And in this case, we've seen, and President Trump said this from the get-go, we're not going to comply with any of the subpoenas, words to that effect, he said very early on. And Attorney General Barr and the Justice Department has defended him in those positions. And so even though in repeated briefings, the department has, you know, asserted that they're providing documents, it really isn't true. Much of what has been requested by the Congress has not been provided, and certainly the testimonies haven't been provided in most of these cases. So, again, we're not going to get, I mean, litigators and will say they've got a clear, you know, answer to these questions, and I think there's no legal support in the Constitution or in any kind of court precedent for unfettered absolute immunity by presidential aides. But beyond that, putting aside, you know, what the arguments in court might be, what's unprecedented here is just the complete sort of defiance and lack of attempts to really work together. And that's just very unfortunate for the country. And it's further divisiveness, further polarization. And, you know, I think is very undermining to our democratic system and our constitutional order, both with a capital C and with a lowercase c.
David Rivkin, let me ask you about we've just got a couple of minutes left, so I want to give you and Mary a chance to wrap up here. But there's another thing in Attorney General Barr's Federalist Society speech, which I wanted to get your brief insight on. When he talked about the framers' clear intent to vest that power in a single person, or the power of the presidency in a single person. I mean, is he talking about the centrality of the actual individual in the office and perhaps loyalty to that individual, or the office of the presidency overall itself?
The latter, very briefly. Look, there are many debates we can have about our constitutional provisions, but the notion that the framers rejected a plural executive, an executive council in favor of unitary executive, I think to me is about 99% abundantly clear. What General Barr is talking about, this absolutely unprecedented notion that there's some authority that a subordinate member of the executive branch can exercise that ultimately is not subject to a president control. To be clear, there are instances where there is a clear obligation by the executive branch to do something pursuant to a statute. But to the extent there's a discretion, either statutory discretion or constitutional discretion, it's always in the president. That's why while presidents typically don't tell Department of Justice how to, for example, to conduct exercise, you know, criminal investigations, prosecutions, for prudential reasons. Mm-hmm. There's nothing, absolutely nothing constitutionally wrong with the president doing that. The president is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. That's what he is talking about. The president is the chief diplomat of the United States, not a bunch of functionaries from the State Department and National Security Council who are undoubtedly good civil servants. The president is the chief general. Okay, not the Secretary of Defense or Chairman of JCS. That's a very compelling point, and you push back against contrary observations that are totally wrong.
Mary, is the president the chief of all of those things?
Well, he's the chief of the executive branch, but that's not the only branch of government. And part of the reason that the framers created three branches, co-equal branches, with checks and balances, separations of powers, is to prevent abuse of power. And that's, you know, part of what's playing out right now.
Well, Mary McCord was acting assistant attorney general for national security at the Justice Department from 2016 to 2017. Currently, she's legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and a visiting professor at Georgetown University's Law Center. Mary McCord, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. It was a pleasure.
And David Rivkin, he served under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush in the White House Counsel's Office and at the Department of Justice. A member of the Federalist Society, though not speaking for the organization today, currently a partner at the law firm of Baker Hostetler. David Rivkin, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you. Spirited debate.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.